You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and starting a month of shows about the crossover between comic books of different international origins, I'm looking at the phenomenon of introducing English language comics and English adaptations of continental comics to the European market. Later in the show, I'm talking to Paul Gravett about the Jack Kirby exhibition that he's co-curated as part of the Fumetto Festival in Lucerne in Switzerland, and also about the English language adaptation of the bande dessinée Largo Winch, which is currently showing in the Cine Lumière at the Institut Français in London. Before that, I'm talking to Francesca Cassavetti, Dan Lester, Sean Azapardi, and Oliver Lambden about their anthology of British small press comics that they published for the Angoulême Festival in France earlier this year. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the programme makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, country, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Francesca Casfetti, Dan Lester, Sean Azapardi and Oliver Lambden about their experiences in Angoulême. To go with you to Angoulême, you curated an anthology called B-A-S-T-A-R-D-S.
British Artists Standing Tall and Reaching Distant Shores.
Was it that when you guys went en masse to Angoulême, you wanted to have a product that you could sort of show was a combined effort rather than you all having mini comics of your own?
Well, actually, we had to submit something.
Okay.
As a collective.
The actual guidelines on the website said that you had to, you could only have one title per table.
Oh.
Which, when we got to the event, turned out that wasn't really that true. But it said you can only have one event per title, and you had to submit a copy of your comic with your application form. So basically, we had to get the anthology ready in order to send a copy with the application. And when we started putting the anthology together, we only actually had about 2 weeks left before we'd have time to send the application form in. So it was basically a matter of necessity, rather than anything else. We would have been happy to just have a bunch of people with their own individual comics, but we had to have a single title to send in. So because of that, we had to put together an anthology, which is why we ended up putting the whole thing together in about 2 weeks, wasn't it?
We approached everyone we knew who might be interested and got them to send in work that they'd already produced because we didn't have time to produce new work and, got it put together and printed, yeah.
Although reading the anthology, some of it was new to me, so was it comics that would have come out anyway, perhaps around the same time? So in fact, it may not be new work, but it was new work in the sense that it hadn't been published on its own, in some cases.
I'm not quite sure. I think all of it had been published somewhere, somehow, maybe, yeah.
Everyone involved is self-publishers, obviously, so they'd all of the work had appeared in some venue or other, whether it was like an individual self-published volume or a smaller anthology. The main reason we did this was because whatever work we put out was going to be new to the audience we're going for, which is the European audience. So we didn't think it mattered that much that it was stuff that had already been printed before, because, like I said, we're going to France and we're doing UK comics. And also, because we had such a short time span to get together, it would be easier to just have work that was already in existence, because otherwise, as in my own experience of putting together anthologies, I normally need to give people like an extra month's time to get work done. It's like whenever I give people a deadline, I work out when is the latest date that I can have work in by, and then I tell people I need it by a month earlier than that. So obviously with this, we only had 2 weeks, so we couldn't do that. So basically you just said send the best like 6 to 10 pages of what you got available. And because we wrote to people that we knew were capable of producing good stuff, we did get a good cross-section of material.
For example, Sean, in the anthology, it's the first time that I've seen the whole of Dreams of Wallace Sendak collected together. So as an anthology, stuff that had only appeared on the web before would appear in print for the first time.
Well, yeah, that's right. I'm afraid I've lost my voice, so I'm going to be absolutely useless at this. But yeah, the idea was to at least give people a taste of stuff that they haven't actually seen before, including possibly the people we were working with as well. So yes, there was quite a variety of stuff that I hadn't seen.
You were the editor, would I right in thinking, of the anthology, Francesca? Oh, okay.
I put it together physically, but we made the decisions together and chased people up, jointly. So.
And for each of the different pieces by the contributors to complement each other, did you send out requirements saying this is the kind of work that I'd like to see representing our group, or was it just the people that you knew would represent the current UK small press scene were the kind of people you wanted to include?
We didn't really have time to put out guidelines. You know, we just picked a group of, we emailed, you know, anyone we knew was capable of doing it, and those who responded and were able to send the work in on time were included, and we knew it would be of a standard because those were the people we contacted.
What we did was we contacted people that we knew were capable of producing good work and just went, if you have like this number of pages of work available that are self-contained, send them to us and we'll put them in the anthology. That was basically it. So other than that, we didn't really give any kind of editorial constraints or a specific...
And they had to contribute to printing costs. constraint, yeah.
But that doesn't really affect the material they submitted. No. We didn't say we wanted any specific stories or anything like that. No. We just said we wanted like 6 to 10 pages of self-contained material.
Oliver, what pieces did you have in the anthology?
Well, I think the brief was you guys turned around and said basically you wanted stuff that was original and ready because the deadline was quite tight, stuff that was already drawn. So I contributed a 2 or 3 page short story which I think originally ran in a Modern Monstrosity anthology we put out in 2006-07, and then a few Curtis and Terrorist pages as well from the Curtis and Terrorist comics that I hand make. So yeah, no, it was nice, it was easy, you know, it's nice getting a call to be included in an anthology but then not have to actually put any work in it. I kind of went through the files of everything that was already on my computer and sent them the stuff which I thought would fit in the best, really. Yeah, it was nice. And it's still doing really well. It's still, the primary reason for making it was to take it to Angoulême, but then we've taken it around to other conventions and it's done very well at kind of British conventions as well.
We have actually sold lots of copies at other events that we've been to before Angoulême, like the MCM Expo. I think Paul Rainey did really well. He sold like 5 copies. And we do actually have copies on sale here. I'm not sure. I think one sold so far. But yeah, so basically it was an anthology we put together to represent ourselves in France, but it's also been good. It's just the UK conventions just as a good representation of a cross-section of UK small press artists.
I've only been to British conventions myself. Sean, you've been to one in Malta. So how did Angoulême compare to British conventions and the Maltese one, for example?
Well, I've been to... this was the third time I've been to Angoulême, not that I'm trying to do bragging rights. And I think, Malta included, the difference between going to a convention abroad rather than say a European one, because obviously we're European, the difference is that you've got a more educated audience that comes to conventions. At a UK convention, you probably have a lot of people that come to look for a specific genre of work, whereas if you go to one... When I went to one in Malta and I went to one in France, they'll just come along, take the work at face value, ask you questions about it. If they like the look of it, they will buy it. They're not so choosy about the fact that it hasn't got people dressed in spandex or it hasn't got a particular genre. It's a more family orientated audience. They actually come out and treat it as a day out and as a day of discovery about the event and the people there. I just find it a much more a welcoming environment, to be quite honest. If I could afford to travel outside the UK, I would do it time and time again. The only thing in the UK now for me really is Thought Bubble and also Caption, because that deals with a specific area, which is self-publishing.
The basic setup of the anthology did seem a little bit cheeky, going for that kind of English relationship with France, particularly the cover which depicts you guys as sort of Viking invaders crossing. How was that picked up on by the French audiences who are buying it?
Well, I'm not sure how they responded to the actual cover image. Although that was kind of a deliberate reference to Asterix. Because, you know, the front cover shows us invading and the back cover shows us kind of like having kind of been defeated and floating in the sea on bits of driftwood. Kind of like the pirates in Asterix. But the name itself that we had, the B-A-S-T-A-R-D-S, a lot of people responded strongly to that or find it amusing. Well, just going back to what you were saying about Sean, about the difference between the British conventions and Angoulême. And a lot of the British conventions I've been to, even though they have a large, small press exhibitors area, most of the people there seem to be there to get a sketch or a signing from a specific artist. It's usually someone who works in mainstream comics. Like, they're there because they want to get Dave Gibbons or Mike Mignola's autograph. Whereas in Angoulême, we were in the alternative town. And that was just that bit on its own was took up more space than most of pretty much any UK convention in its entirety. And that was just the alternative tent. It was also the mainstream tent and the foreign rights tent and the manga tent. So the thing itself was massive. And also is the fact that the convention kind of took over the whole town, because we'd be walking through the town to get to the supermarket or the bus stop. And there'd be like opticians and estate agents, which would have massive comics displays in the windows, which you wouldn't get in Birmingham. And then you can't even find the convention itself because you have to walk through a science exhibit.
Presumably you guys, while you were in Angoulême, got to experience some of the local comics events that were going on, some of the rest of the French small press scene. Did you exchange comics with other people who had come to the convention from other parts of the world?
Yeah, I think we were, to our right-hand side were some German creators selling some anthologies, and then some Italians on the other side, and then across from us were Croatians and Slovenians. Yeah, but there was a fair bit of swapping going on. In terms of the other events going on around the town, I had a bit of a wonder. I tried to look around at some of the other tents, but I think Sean probably did the best in terms of taking in all of the different things that Angoulême had to offer. I mean, I can't wait to go back next year just to explore a bit more. I think the novelty of being able to sit there was taking over the first time. But
I tried not to be too overbearing, because of somebody that's been there before, you don't want to give people that have been there the first time, you don't want to tramp on their experience, because everybody has to discover an event for the first time. So because I was aware of the setup and that, I could relax a little bit more and just go off and find the things that I wanted to. And I did try to actively encourage people to get from behind the table and go around, but because of the actual size of just the single tent that we're in, it's very easy for the 4 days that we're there to just sit there and just be fairly overwhelmed by the size of the crowd just going around the one tent. So,
and also just about 10 yards further up from our table, there was a small stall selling beer and sandwiches.
At some of the recent British conventions, I've noticed that you've had Swedish creators, Canadian creators, German creators bringing out sampler comics in British, presumably to try and sell them to, obviously, English-speaking comics fans. The fact that you were taking a British anthology in English to France, was that a problem at all to people buying it there?
No, it actually wasn't. One of the interesting points to me was that a lot of French people coming around specifically looking for English comics because they wanted to teach English to their children. And when we set up, I was saying the fact that we're putting an anthology together for France, we need to have it translated into French because it's going to be like a bit of a dud, was an ill-founded comment on my part, because people were actively seeking English language comics.
Well, there's also the fact that because even though it takes place in France, it is actually a genuinely international event. So basically there were people from other countries in Europe, like Switzerland or Germany or Finland, wherever, people who didn't necessarily speak French but did speak English. So because of that, we could appeal to people on that basis, because there were more people there that spoke English than there were speaking French.
The idea that an international convention means that you've just got somebody from America, it has to be a little bit broader than that. And until that's actually embraced at a lot of the UK conventions, it is a very narrow viewpoint.
When people say they have an international event, it just means that they've invited Mike Mignola and Howard Chaykin. Whereas with this, it did actually mean there were people from various different countries. Because, like, it's already been said, we had Italians on one side, Germans on the other. Slovenians and Croats and Swedish people as well. People from loads of different countries, rather than just a British convention with a couple of American artists.
Francesca, you spent some of your formative years in France.
I did.
And I got the impression that going to Angoulême had been an ambition of yours for quite some time.
Yeah, it had. Because it was like tackling the French comics industry, which is something I grew up with. They're, you know, just coming face to face with an awful lot of heroes of mine, people I've been reading since I was a child. And kind of scary in a way, because it was like being a very small fish in a much bigger pond, because it's a much bigger and more impressive industry than the industry over here. And yeah, it was like coming home really in a way, except no, because I was a foreigner, so I was safe.
And what was the reaction like to the anthology from people who bought it, people who just casually walked past your display?
I think people were intrigued and amused at the acronym, and we had quite a good reaction. I mean, yeah, obviously only the people who were interested in exploring something other than French comics, so who were, you know, as Dan and Sean said, people who wanted to maybe improve their English or who were a bit more curious were interested. But no, we got pretty good reaction, and the organisers seemed quite pleased with our sort of presentation and what our turnout. So no, it was good. We felt welcome.
If you don't mind me asking, how many copies did you take with you, and how many did you sell?
I think we had about 20 copies, and we sold about 13 or 14, which is good. On top of all, we obviously took all our other comics with us, and Sean sold out all his copies. Oliver sold a lot of copies. I mean, we all sold decent amounts of what we'd taken with us, so it was a very positive experience. And it was good to have contact with people. We noticed in France people seem to expect a drawing.
Yeah.
With, if they bought a copy, they would expect you to autograph it and do a drawing. Slightly different from here. They had different expectations. But it was all incredibly positive from the point of view of the organisation and the public that came in.
Okay, thank you very much.
For more info about Francesca, Dan, Sean and Oliver's anthology, please visit their website www.bastardscomic.blogspot.com. That's bastardscomic.blogspot.com. Next, here's my interview with Paul Gravett about Jack Kirby in Lucerne and bringing the work of Jean Van Hamme to the UK.
My theme this month is cross-cultural comics, which is to say the dialogue between comic creators and comics that are associated with one country being imported to another. So, for example, my guest next week is Pat Mills, who's talking about doing comics for the French market.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that Requiem series, for example. Yeah.
And my other guest this week is Francesca Cassavetti, who did an anthology called BASTARDS,
yes.
Which was showing independent British artists and was on sale at the Angoulême Festival earlier this year.
Big fan there, yeah, yeah. Exactly. That's a good theme. Yeah. I guess you could say Kirby fits that, being shown in of all places in Lucerne, yeah. Mm.
How did this Kirby exhibition come about?
The starting point is Dan Liddell from Picture Box. He's a New York publisher. And you may know he's written several very good books. He did a recent one called Art Out of Time for Abrams, and a new one out just now called Art in Time. And he just suggested it. He was at Fumetto, the comics festival, last year, and just said to the director, Lynn Cost, you should do Jack Kirby. And it's a bold thing to have suggested, because it's not really what Fumetto has normally been doing. I think it's the 19th festival this year, and Fumetto, if anything, is known... It's famous, really, for being absolutely on the cutting edge of avant-garde and art comics, experimental stuff, and with a lot of strong crossover with contemporary art. I mean, it's a very different to Angoulême, for example. There's no publishers, tents and booths and stands and things. There's just one very good comic shop, you know, one big shop for the festival's headquarters. And the main focus is lots and lots of interesting exhibitions, usually by, you know, up-and-coming and some fairly biggish names from the comics world, not just from around the world, in fact, quite international, but nothing, you know, retrospective before. And I think it grew in momentum when this fantastic location became available. It's this three-story, I think it's something like 16th or 17th century. It's very old anyway. A beautiful three-story townhouse that has been, over the last few years, has been a Picasso museum, would you believe? And they've moved all the Picassos out to another larger place where they're also showing work by Matisse and Paul Klee, and have the space available for the festival. And so that's where they thought they could put it on. And I got involved with Fermetto because I was one of the jury members judging that. They do an annual competition, a very good one actually, and they get entries from all over the world for that. And when I heard about the fact that they were doing a Kirby show, I'm afraid I kind of rather shamelessly said, well, no, I was just a kind of help. I didn't expect anything more than just, you know, I said, well, I could maybe put some, find you some collectors who might be able to help out or just advise or who knows what. And it turned out that Dan graciously said, well, why don't we co-create it and do it together? Him from the US end and me from the, you know, UK Europe end. And it's worked out very well, in fact. We've been able to locate material and put the show on.
And what is the nature of the exhibition? Is it original artwork, reproductions, art
that's
been...
original artwork, that's the main thing. And okay. Where possible to show a good broad span of material. I mean, the earliest pieces we've got are amazing. They're from 19... I think the absolute oldest one is from 1942, and these are incredibly fragile and miraculous things to survive. They are sort of style sheets, essentially character studies of the faces of the Boy Commando's characters, made by Kirby in pencil, as references for the studio, the Simon and Kirby studio artists who weren't going off to war, as Simon and Kirby were at that point or about to, so they could produce more stories while they were away. And they're just extraordinary to find those. And that goes right through to, I think about the latest work we got is around from about 1985 or so. So that comes from Silver Star, one of the last sort of major works that Kirby produced in the 80s. So it spans a really good amount of time. And the goal was really, where possible, to sort of try and find really outstanding examples and put them into some kind of chronology, make some sort of sense of Kirby's career for people who don't know anything about him, maybe only vaguely know that he had heard of Stan Lee probably more than Jack Kirby. And he used the room, there were seven galleries on three floors, as a chronology that we could kind of theme each room and make it work. Dan was having some difficulties persuading some, there were of course loads of collectors in America, but some of them were reluctant, and I don't completely understand it, to lend, especially as it was going to be, you know, outside America. My God, it's going to leave the mother country and go to that weird outside world that Americans sometimes think about, the rest of the world being sort of full of danger and terrorists and goodness knows. But, and the collectors, obviously, are not necessarily lenders. Collectors are people that want to keep their things and look after them. And these are, of course, increasingly valuable. I mean, Kirby's artwork has gone up in, I gather, in the last sort of, certainly since around 2000 or so, it's gone up stratospherically, in fact. Mm. But fortunately, he did find a couple of people. In the meantime, I found a couple of people here. Two lenders here in London, and then another important lender in Paris that made all the difference. And so between us, we've got some really fantastic work. And it really is, there's something like, I was trying to do a count up in my head as we're walking through the galleries and things. I think there's something, if you count double page spread as two, which they are, of course, two pieces of artwork, two pages, there's something like 161 pieces on show. And on top of that, we've got reproductions of pencils, we've got rare photographs, letters from the wartime period when he was writing home to his wife, Rosalind, and some other documentary material. So that really makes it quite a rich exhibition. So, yeah, it's definitely a landmark in that sense.
Yeah. Well, because the reason I asked about how the art was going to be displayed was because one of my favourite books on Kirby is the Maximum Fantastic Four book that came out a few years ago.
Oh, yes.
Just because the idea of blowing up individual panels to the pages of a coffee table book brings a sort of...
Was behind the whole thing, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. It was a very good afterword. The book, I think, was worth it for the afterword. Yeah.
Because I'm just saying that it brings a kind of Lichtenstein quality to Kirby's artwork.
Yeah, each panel is a work of you can look at it individually, its composition and its impact. In fact, I was looking at Fantastic Four number one today on one of the collectors, Tom Craft, came back with me to Zurich from Lucerne, and he was showing me FF1 on his iPad. And I hadn't seen what the application was quite like when you were reading a comic on an iPad. It actually works rather well. Because that too, if you can highlight individual panels. Mm. It takes them out of, you can see the whole page, of course, and as you click and zoom in, you can, and to see a particular panel, it'll actually come up full screen size individually. And I think that's, again, rather like that maximum FF book, as you say.
Yeah.
But in fact, then they were blow-ups. I mean, the good thing is that as well as the original art book, of course, that they were emphasizing the pop art aspects, the fantastic, you know, graphic impact of sort of individual panels. And there were two lovely double page spreads, one from Devil Dinosaur, one from 2001 Space Odyssey. So quite late ones, of course, from Marvel 76 or so. But they looked fabulous because they were literally turned into wallpaper, actually, at a gigantic blow ups on the stairwells as you go up between the floors. And they were spectacular. I mean, the woman who did the Photoshop retouching did an amazing job to really clean them up. And then there were a couple of other really striking individual panels blown up, which have, of course, a pop art look to them. And they partly chose ones, I think, that kind of make you think of perhaps Lichtenstein's romance comics, where they have Mr. Miracle and Big Barda, they had Johnny Storm and Crystal in sort of kind of pop arty looking panels, of course. That was part of the link to it. I mean, the reason why the show was put on in Lucerne, and it's also because, of course, Kirby is a cult figure, but he's not a cult figure, not in the same way, not seen in the same way, of course, in Europe as he is in America. He's not known as well, and he has a certain sort of mystique, if you like, and he has a big influence, of course, on a lot of the more alternative and avant-garde artists. I mean, in America, it's quite well known. People like Gary Panter and a whole generation have come along since Panter, like Matt Brinkman and others, are hugely influenced by Kirby, but quite a few in Europe too, and it shows how Kirby's artwork and Kirby's influence can kind of spread in all sorts of surprising ways. And I think it's been a good step for Meta to take this project on. It's been, the crowds of people going to it was very encouraging.
Cool. But I mean, it's funny you saying that Kirby is lesser known to an extent in Europe seems almost heretical to people in Britain, because the British seem to be far more obsessed with superhero comics than our European companions. And this is something that I'm discussing with Pat, the fact that, he's sort of scratched an itch by making comics for the European market when so many people in this country seem to be ignorant of just how rich the European comic world is.
Yeah, quite right. And of course, what he's doing in a sense there, he's doing work that's not so different from perhaps from 2000 AD, the science fiction tradition. I mean, it's quite similar, isn't it, than Requiem, except I think he's able to go a good deal wilder, of course, because it's not catering for a kind of, for in theory, still relatively non-adult only, whatever, a market. And he can go, and of course the artist is going, does some incredible work. Yeah, I think the difference really is that Kirby stands as somebody that's too familiar, almost, in a way. We've kind of taken for granted. And if you think about it, it's ridiculous. He died in 1994, and there have been a few shows spotlighting him. I mean, he was in Masters Comic Art, the show that toured in America and started off in Los Angeles in both the Museum of Contemporary Art and the Hammer Museum. Two museums, would you believe, devoted to this big show, spotlighting 15 key American artists, going right back to Harriman and McKay, and of course Kirby, quite rightly, was one of those. But that was only one room, it wasn't a whole house. And of course, in fact, in 1994, shortly after Kirby died, I was working at the Cartoon Art Trust at the time, and I was able to put on a very modest tribute, with one or two of the pieces that ended up appearing in this show, from collectors here in London. But there hasn't, it's crazy, we are 16 years later, and there still hasn't been a major solo, retrospective exhibition of Kirby's work. And this, in some senses, it is the biggest so far, but I think both Dan Nadell and I feel this is kind of like a benchmark, a sort of statement of this deserves to be done on a much bigger scale. And somebody, whether it's going to be perhaps in America or may even be over here, somewhere here in Europe, or maybe even London or something bigger needs to come along in the coming year or two to really do full justice to Kirby's career and achievements.
Mm. Well, I suppose that's the thing. With the recent lavish DC and Marvel reprints of his work as omnibuses, it wasn't that long ago that actually Kirby was being neglected by the mainstream comic book creators, because I was leafing through some Eclipse and independent titles from the early 80s. And I think it was in 1987 when it was the supposed 25th anniversary of Marvel, and they were celebrating that in their comics. Loads of people took out an advert in alternative comics saying, it's the 25th anniversary of Marvel, but why aren't you celebrating Jack Kirby?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I wouldn't mind seeing those adverts, really.
Yes, oh, well, yeah, I'll lend them to you. It's weird, obviously,
because
how people...
Because around the time, maybe a bit earlier, but there have been all the hoo-ha, of course, of the controversy of Marvel holding on to the artwork and the whole dispute and settlement eventually, so that Kirby got some of his originals back. That, of course, was a major issue, of course, at the time. Yeah. Interesting.
And then the other project that you're currently involved in, Tomorrow Night, which, as far as as far as our listeners is concerned, is actually yesterday. This whole recording things in advance does make it a bit like time travel. There's a screening of Largo Winch as part of a whole week of screenings at the Cine Lumiere in Knightsbridge. And Tomorrow Night's screening is being accompanied by a Q&A by the creator of the comic as well.
It's the author, Jean Benham, that's right. Yeah, he's coming up. He's known to some people maybe as the co-writer of the screenplay to the Jean-Jacques Benex film Diva, which was a great film, wasn't it, of course? But yeah, he's the author also of Thorgal and Trez, or 13, which is also going to be launched properly by Cinebooks last night. last night. Yeah, and 13 is a phenomenally successful action sort of conspiracy amnesia thriller, I guess you might call it, which took like something like 20 years, an album a year pretty much to come out. I mean, the French are very patient for their serials. You thought Lost took a long time, and then 13 took much longer. But now we're getting it from Cinebooks in bi-monthly albums, and it means the whole story will wrap up in 2013, very appropriately. And it's definitely a course of celebration, because the series 13, I should mention, has had false starts twice, once from Catalan Communications back in the 80s, once from, more recently from Marvel, I think I'm not sure how you say that, but Debiel Brothers did it as a kind of tie into the computer game, I think, based on 13. And they both sort of did it badly, basically, pretty much, and then stopped after only three books. And so it's great that Cinebook will be doing the entire run. And it's, basically, if you had Jean Vanel appearing in France or Belgium, there would be hoo-ha, there would be... but of course, over here, he's not quite as well known yet. I have to keep explaining to people it's not Jean-Claude Van Damme, for example.
But yeah, I mean, in a summer that's seeing the release of Kick-Ass, Iron Man 2, The Losers, obviously Largo Winch, as a European comic book movie, is possibly going to be neglected slightly. So
neglected because it came out in 2008.
Well, there you go.
So it's been waiting for some kind of cinematic or some sort of release, and of course it's not made. It's even been made in English. It's not even anyone worried about watching subtitles. It's made for export, and it just hasn't had a chance, which is an indictment, I think, of the way that we kind of don't allow French stuff in. And then, as you may know, in the last couple of weeks, another film came out in France based on a bande dessinée. It's the Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec, which is Hardy's series. It's the new film from Luc Besson. And I hope that one might get a screen. That one might just cross over, but of course it is made in French. It would have to be either dubbed or subtitled, I suppose. But it'll be really interesting to meet Van. I've only met him very briefly and hear what he's up to. I know there's been all sorts of other things. I mean, the 13 series was adapted for American TV. It was on just over Christmas time, I noticed, on something like Channel 5 or something, kind of just tucked away. But that was, again, an English language TV adaptation of part of the story. But, so Van Am, yes, a name, definitely a name. And they're doing a sequel already. There's a follow-up to Largo Winch underway. So we just don't know about it, but it's worth discovering.
Well,
if you can. Can I come back to Kirby just a bit, though,
to
tell people a bit more about it? Because I think we ought to just sort of credit, I do want to thank some of the people that made it possible. We would never have got anywhere, of course, without the Kirby Museum, which, as you know, is at the moment a virtual online museum, but there are hopes to sort of establish a proper bricks and mortar building. And I had a chance the first time, I've only met him over the phone, as it were, before, but to meet Rand Hoppe, who is the prime mover of this whole thing, who, of course, works very closely with the Kirby estate. And provided some wonderful material for the exhibition and have been very, very supportive. And then two of the three big American collectors who lent, unfortunately Scott Eder couldn't make it, but Tom Morehouse and his wife and Tom Craft, the two Toms, made it over, especially, and that was a great treat to meet with them. And then, of course, Dan and I were there, so we had a lot of... it was really Kirby... This is deep nerd, I think was the phrase that... Dan Nobel came up with, deep nerd, as in sort of really seriously kind of detailed meals and discussions and analyses about Kirby. It was a great time to have to do that. And the missing person were the other collectors from the UK. Of course, Jonathan Ross lent a lot of material, and we were so hugely grateful to him. But he didn't want to risk the volcano going off again and being stuck somewhere in this Lucerne and missing his programs, I guess. So he didn't make it over. And nor did Bernard Mahe. He's the Paris-based collector and dealer. He runs a gallery there who lent some amazing work. He was away, in fact, in another festival. This past weekend has been a fantastic comics festival in Naples, which I'd love to go to. Mm-hmm. And he did a big exhibition there on Will Eisner. So just think, wow, all these wonderful things happening just across the channel in Europe. And the thing that Bernard was able to lend, and this is one of the key things about the exhibition, we could probably have had 160-something pages from a different page from every different possible series. There are plenty of series, unfortunately, it has to be said, that we weren't able to represent. Going right back to the Captain America, for example, from the 40s, it's a very hard thing to locate originals for that. On the other hand, what we did want to do from the outset was, where possible, just to show some complete stories, both short stories and full-length comic books. Mm-hmm. And brilliantly, there are three amazing complete comic books on show. One of them from Bernard Mahe is actually, it's Fantastic Four 54, which is an amazing issue. Okay, it isn't the Silver Surfer or Galactus, but it's still from an amazing period. It's absolutely when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby are completely in their prime, doing the best material ever. And we're really, to be honest, of course, it's Kirby that's really driving the story, because he's the one not just drawing it, but writing it, plotting it. He's not dialoguing it. That's down to Stan Lee to do in afterwards. But you can see we have 18 out of 20 of the pages from FF54. And it's a great story. It incorporates scenes with the Human Torch and White Wingfoot discovering Prester John, who is this legendary character, and then other storyline involving the Black Panther with Reed Richards and Sue Storm and the Thing, and then another story with the Inhumans. You've got Black Bolt appearing. So it's all these wonderful soap opera continuities going on in that issue. And just amazing. And one of the seven galleries, we just said, we've got to devote the whole gallery just to showing these 18 pages. And they are large, of course, and spectacular. And it really puts across, I think, that you think about, this is something that was produced on a monthly basis. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just one thing. I mean, Kirby was also doing Thor at the same time. And he cut down, of course, from the early sort of manic period of Marvel's first explosion. But he was still also doing Captain America at the time. So he was producing 2.5 books in a month. And, of course, not from any complete scripts, but definitely in many ways. He was the director and storyteller, and Lee came in afterwards to fill in the text and captions, the balloons.
Yeah.
So, an amazing thing. And the other two complete stories we've got from Jonathan Ross, we've got the complete Commandy 6, which is just one of the most fantastic episodes of Commandy. It's called Flower, and it's a storyline where Commandy befriends. He's basically been trapped, of course, by these traders. The whole storyline is he's the last boy on Earth, and the animals are now ruling the planet, and humankind is reduced to being sort of chattels and slaves and sort of pets. And he befriends and falls in love, essentially, with this little girl called Flower, who can hardly speak properly. And they end up in a very, very, very powerful, dramatic scene at the end, where they think they found some kind of shelter, and he realizes that in fact it's a zoo where humans such as him are being kept in captivity, and predators, essentially sort of poachers, break in and shoot Flower. So it's a very sort of sad ending, and it's really tremendous pathos to it, and it's one of Kirby's masterpieces from 73, I think it is. And to have all of that on the show is also fantastic. And the third full-length comic we've got is Our Fighting Forces 156, featuring the Losers. You mentioned the Losers earlier. This is not the same as Andy Diggle and Jock's version. This is the original characters, the wartime characters. And Kirby, of course, was assigned this, and they weren't his characters. He wasn't, I don't think, terribly enthusiastic about the job. I mean, he prefers to create his own material. But he brought all of his wartime experiences and atmosphere and memories to bear on it. And it's a really tremendous late piece that we've got that all across one wall as well, and in the last room on the top floor. Mm. And just briefly, just we'll get you a real pause for a moment, don't worry. The other complete stories we've got, which are exciting, I think, are we have a complete Fighting American 7-page story, City of Ghouls from Fighting American 2. So that's classic sort of 1950-something Simon and Kirby. There's also a complete story from the 50s, a fantasy story called I Want to Be a Man, featuring a bizarre robot character called Fabiac, which is not a Marvel one, isn't it? It's a Harvey alarming tale story, but still a fascinating example. So those are the... Oh, and the other one, of course, you've got is a complete episode of the unpublished and wonderful Soul Love was going to be was Jack Kirby's new genre of black romance comics, but a magazine, and a whole issue was produced, and it wasn't published. Huh. And it's amazing stuff. It's just obviously Kirby had already innovated with Joe Simon the romance genre in 47. I mean, in American comic books at least, it was a new genre, and here he is going to DC in 70-71, and saying, why don't we try black and white magazines, and we could do one. One of them was Soul Love, so we have a complete 5-page story, and inked, fascinatingly, inked in this case by a Filipino artist who some people will know. His name is Tony Dezuniga, I think that's how you pronounce it. He was the co-creator of Jonah Hex, soon to be a film, as you may know, that's coming up this year. And he's a fantastic inker for Kirby. I just hadn't realized how good it was. This is an example of that. So, I think, and is that all of them? I think there must be some more. Yes, there's other stuff, but those are the main full-length stories. So I think it's good to give people that, because they aren't made up one page at a time. I mean, they are obviously drawn one page at a time, but they're made to be experienced as complete, storytelling experiences. And it's great that we can include them in the show.
Mm. Well, it sounds amazing, and hopefully some of our listeners might be able to make it to Lucerne before the end of the week.
It's until Sunday, until the 9th.
And then, fingers crossed, you may be able to bring some of this work to a future exhibition in Brussels.
Well, it's going to go back to Olympus at the moment, but certainly having done this, I think hopefully the goodwill will spread from our American friends as well, and we can hopefully do something else in the future on a much bigger scale.
Cool.
The exhibition of Jack Kirby in Lucerne runs until Sunday. More info at www.fumetto.ch. That's www.fumetto.ch. And you'll find that link and more info about all the topics covered in today's show on our blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. In our next episode, I'm talking to Pat Mills about creating work specifically for the European market, such as Shah and Requiem Vampire Night, how some of his British work, such as his collaborations with the late John Hicklinton, were better appreciated on the continent. And that's at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.